The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is the Read to Lead podcast, episode 523.
Hey, I'm Chris Ducker, author of Virtual Freedom and host of the New Business Podcast. And you've just stumbled upon one of my favorites. It's the Read to Lead podcast with my buddy, Jeff Brown.
The best strategies for success in the workplace are not so much taught as they are expected to be known. Worse still, there's a pervasive myth that some people have it and some don't. The characteristics of successful people, competence, ambition, humility, dependability, good communication, are often wrongly considered innate traits rather than larger skills that can be dissected and learned in smaller pieces, what today's guests call micro skills. Hi, I'm Jeff, and this is the Read to Lead podcast, of course, and I am back with a brand new episode for the first time in several weeks. I'm glad you're here, and you're going to be glad you're here when you hear more about today's topic, today's book, and today's not one, but two amazing guests. Their book is called Micro Skills, Small Actions, Big Impact, and they are Drs. Adara Landry and Risa Lewis. I'll ask them why they suggest we set limits on the time we spend in meetings and how to go about making it happen, why it's important to learn to take a pause rather than being quick to accept new opportunities, some of the key things leaders and team members need to understand in order to deliver feedback that can actually be put to use, and plenty more. Hey, if you're looking to hone your note-taking skills, April is a great month to join the Read to Lead community with a Read to Lead Plus membership. Note-taking is our theme for April. In fact, we'll be welcoming in a guest expert next week, Jorge Arango, who has written a book called Duly Noted. As a member, you get special access to our guests each month, sometimes even free copies of their book, monthly AMAs with me, free book summaries, and much more. It's just $9 a month. To find out more, just go to jeffbrown.me and you can start a free 2-week trial right now. That's jeffbrown.me. Dr. Adara Landry is an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and an emergency medicine physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital, who studied and trained at University of California, Berkeley, University of California, Los Angeles, New York University, and Harvard, with almost a decade of experience mentoring students and early career professionals. She is an entrepreneur, keynote speaker, award-winning mentor, and a healthcare contributor for Forbes. And she co-founded Writing in Color, a nonprofit that teaches the craft of writing. Dr. Risa Lewis is a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, TEDMED speaker, Time's Up Healthcare founder, designer, entrepreneur, and award-winning educator, mentor, and point-of-care ultrasound specialist. She studied at Brown University, the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, the NIH Howard Hughes Research Scholars Program, Harvard Emergency Medicine, and Mount Sinai St. Luke's Roosevelt. And she hosts the Visible Voices podcast, amplifying content in the healthcare, equity, and current trends spaces. Well, I'm very excited to have the two of you here. I know it was kind of touch and go. We thought it might just be one of you, but thank you both for making it. I am very excited about that. Dr. Lewis, welcome. I'll start with you. Thank you for being here.
Amazing to be here with you. Thank you.
And Dr. Landry, likewise.
Thank you so much. Really excited.
Well, I want to start with a question that grabbed me right away when I first found out about this book, what to me was a book that's going to help a ton of people in their career. I think especially people starting out, not just people starting out, but especially people early in their career, how do two physicians come together to write this kind of a book? I would imagine that when you came together to do this, that many people thought it might be about a different topic entirely. So how does that happen? I'll start with you, Risa, and I want to hear from you on this topic too, Adara.
Appreciate that question. A lot of people, when they see women physicians, emergency physicians writing a book, they think this possibly can't be meant for me. And it is. So we wrote the category business self-help. We didn't designate that category. That's a category. It's a business self-help book. And we really think it is useful to a general audience. So healthcare, medicine, the emergency department, it's a workplace just like any other workplace. There are teams, there are team members. There has to be people management. There has to be communication. There's plenty of conflict. There's plenty of opportunity to work on the micro skills that we describe in the book. And I think during the pandemic, Dara and I had a proof of concept of publishing articles in mainstream outlets such as Harvard Business Review, Fast Company. And we saw that our writing and lessons learned about the workplace were generalizable and resonated well with everybody.
Yeah, when we started the process of writing the book, we had to read comparative titles. So other titles that have tackled similar issues of navigating the workplace. Many of them, as you might have assumed, are written by corporate C-suite older men who are at the executive level and writing for potentially others who aspire for that type of a job. Mm. You know, Risa and I are physicians who really understand the holistic view of the human experience because of our profession, right? We treat people, yes, with their physical needs, but we also talk about mental health and how work can be exhausting and how that affects their access to feeling, you know, in control over their lives. And there's a lot of interplay here. So we really wanted to write about how to be successful at work without necessarily practicing self-sacrifice, without just putting your head down and grinding away. And I think that human touch is probably coming from our profession, being physicians. But we also wanted to inject a lot of strategy. I mean, we have achieved a lot, many different institutions, many different titles, many different awards and publications. And yet it wasn't super easy for us to get there. We didn't have anyone handing us this playbook, as Risa calls it, of all of the exact to-dos to get there. There were a lot of lessons. So we understand the grind. We understand the feeling of being unsupported, the isolation, but we also understand the value of networking, the value of being a good communicator. And so a lot of the book, yes, has some medical stories in there to, you know, captivate the audience and to share what we do on a regular basis. But the themes are really transferable, right? The themes of being a team player, of learning your workplace culture, these are transferable themes. They just have a lot of content that is related to just being a human in a workplace.
Mm. Talk a bit about how you decided to lay out the book. As I look at the different chapters, you've got micro skills on how to grow your network, on how to navigate conflict, finding new opportunities. Like, what went into maybe narrowing, I would assume, what was maybe at first a longer list of micro skills. Maybe you had to cut some things. What went into deciding how to lay this out and what to include and what not to include?
We read this book called Write Useful Books. I don't know if you've ever referenced that or if any of the other authors you've had on but it's a really good book on how to write a nonfiction book. So anyone who's thinking about nonfiction, start there. And one of the pieces of advice that was shared was to really hone in on your table of contents, because that is the map, that is the framework for your entire book. So we spent weeks, months, maybe, interviewing people, asking them what they would want covered, what they would want us to address, and, you know, what might not be relevant, and just chiseling. I want to use that word chisel because we almost named the book Chiseled, but chiseling that list to be super tight. And one of the other things that was mentioned in that book, Write Useful Books, was to make your subtitles super descriptive. Like, someone would know exactly what you're going to cover in that chapter. Mm. And when we read that, we looked at our prior table of contents, our existing table of contents. And a lot of those micro skills were super vague. The chapter titles were super vague. What I'm saying is that we had a really good reference point that really told us some of the key steps to sharpen that table of contents. We started the book with self-care because we believe in the workplace, everything starts with the self. You know, you have to understand your own mental health, your own physical health, your own financial health, your own social health. All of that is really important. And that's why we started with self-care, because only when those things are intact can you start to think about the team. Can you start to think about the work?
Industries, workplaces don't teach people that. And healthcare is one of the worst offenders. Doctors are actually really good at taking care of other people, but they're not particularly good at taking care of themselves. And this is not a judgment. This is not a blaming the victim. This is not what is modeled. This is not what is lauded. This is not even what people praise and brag about. You know, I was up all night and I had a full day of meetings and I saw patients in the office. You know, that is, you know, I didn't sleep and I drove home. And we actually tell a story that you probably read in the book about sleep and sleep for health, and that, you know, after a night shift, hoping that I wouldn't hit any red lights or I would do a route that minimized stop signs. When I was working in New York City, standing up, not sitting down on the subway, or I would wake up in Queens rather than hitting my stop in Manhattan. Right. True story, true story.
You guys mentioned self-care. You encourage us to set limits on time we spend in meetings. I think most people hearing that would be saying, yes, please teach me how I can do this. What are some strategies we might try to achieve this goal?
To add some context to that, there was one point in time where I had three professional titles at one time, plus two young children. And so I felt like I didn't have any time to actually do creative work. I was in meetings all day long because of all the different positions. And then I come home and I had my kids and I just felt like there was no time to actually do the work. You know what I mean? I felt like I was in meetings talking about what I needed to do, but I didn't actually have time. It was really helpful for me to speak with a colleague who had no professional titles other than just being a clinician. Mm. He had no academic title at all. And I said, how are you able to publish and go do all these lectures and get these huge grants? Like, how are you actually able to do all of that work? And he said, let me see your calendar. Like, how are you not fitting this in? I showed him my calendar for the week and he said, oh my God, you were in so many meetings. You have to cut these meetings. Mm. And so part of that was, yes, I definitely started saying no to things that were optional. There were a lot of optional meetings that I was just, you know, let me go just to see what they have to say. But the other thing was that the more titles you have, the more meetings you have. So actually, when I stepped down from two of my titles, a lot of my calendar opened up. But going forward, even for the position I still have, I'm always just thinking about the thresholds for me for taking a meeting, right? Like raising the threshold before I say yes to something. So is this necessary? Am I necessary? Is this going to be helpful for my career? And is this at a time where, like, you know, I'm on vacation? If I'm on vacation, I really don't want to be on a meeting. And sort of like allowing myself to raise the threshold. One of the other things that I do, remaining position, is I'm an advisor for the medical school. And when I started, I assumed that the meetings needed to be 1 hour for each student. And I realized that, like, that was just way too much time. Mm-hmm. And so I trimmed those meetings down to 20 to 30 minutes and made them way more efficient, where I had an agenda, I had them send me questions early, and we were just able to really focus. So by shortening the meetings, that really, really helped me as well. I also try to have some meetings at certain points of the day, like Friday mornings, I do a lot of my mentoring meetings. Mm-hmm. And then Friday evenings, I say, I don't really want to have anything because I want to finish up work from like the week. So I really try to keep my Friday from like 1 to 4 to 5 p.m. from being full of meetings again. Yeah. And so all of these like small steps helped me trim down the meetings, especially after I thought about all of the titles that I had that were really overwhelming my calendar.
I certainly have found value myself in setting aside specific days of the week where meetings happen and other specific days of the week where meetings tend not to happen, and sort of regimenting it that way has been very, very helpful to me. Maybe you could add something to this, Risa. One aspect of this I'm curious about is for someone listening who may not always have a say in whether or not they attend a meeting. What would you say to that, or what advice would you give them?
So 100%, we are not naive to the fact that certain meetings are mandatory. We are giving a little bit of a hat tip to those that are not mandatory, or those that you yourself are planning and even thinking, you know, culturally, I think people are like, we need a meeting, but maybe you don't need a meeting. Like, maybe you can text about this. Maybe you can do a 15-minute phone call. We also think, you know, air expands to fill the room. meetings expand to fill the time allotted. So probably a 60-minute meeting could be a 30 or a 20-minute meeting. A 20, 30-minute meeting might be able to be a 15 or a 10-minute meeting. You know, a 15, 20-minute meeting, maybe you don't need it. And this can get accomplished asynchronously via Slack or via a Google document or via email. So just to sort of create options and to think about things differently. So circling back, you know, certain things are mandatory. And if you have ways that you want to free up the mandatories, you can actually speak with the team leader or your supervisor. Can this be recorded and I can catch up later? Can someone take notes? And, you know, maybe we rotate the note taker so that then some people don't have to attend in a rotation. And then, you know, if you're the note taker, obviously you have to attend, but maybe then that allows sometimes that you don't have to be present.
I want to double down on what Risa said about mini meetings actually being more optional than you think. You know, we wrote this book. I don't think we've ever really had more than one meeting a week. And there were many weeks where we had zero meetings at all. Mm-hmm. We spent, the first half or so creating this book using asynchronous voice messaging only. So she would send me a message. I would listen to it when it's convenient to me. And then I would reply. And that was how we communicated, I would say, the first year and a half of the book.
You know, that rings true for me. I co-wrote a book about 3 years ago now, maybe 2.5 years ago. And we even lived at the time in the same town, my co-author and I, but probably 95% of the meetings we had about the book were asynchronous. I think we had one in-person meeting and maybe one or two via Zoom, but everything else was Slack or some or email or something like that. Speaking of email, for many of us, it's become a necessary evil, I think, in some ways. What do you guys mean when you say that mastering the art of the carbon copy and the blind carbon copy is considerate rather than sneaky if you do it right?
We started this writing journey together through articles. We call it our proof of concept. And one of our hit it out of the park articles, about which we're very proud, and a lot of people bring it up, is a compassionate email culture. And people are like, what? Like, what's compassionate about emails? But the premise of that article was rather than focusing on your own inbox and inbox zero, think about the other person's inbox. So flip it 180. And that's the compassionate part. So we start from a place of thinking about what you're writing, to whom you're writing. Does it need to be written? Who needs to really, really be on it? And then utilize the tools. Most people know about the to line. They know about the CC line. But we think one of the most underappreciated, underutilized, maybe disrespected tools is the BCC, the blind carbon copy. Most of us are familiar that it is used maybe weaponized nefariously and, you know, to create a paper trail to make sure the supervisor is following along. And we really say that's not so kind. That's not so respectful. There are very kind, very respectful ways to use the BCC. And I'll give two examples. Someone gets a promotion and everybody is on the congratulations to Jeff. Jeff Brown got promoted. And everybody replies and wants to give their congratulations. So the next thing you know, you have about 30 emails of congratulations, Jeff, congratulations, great job. I knew you could do it. And, you know, there are ways to do that where I can send the email out and I can put all of our colleagues in the BCC. And you make sure you let everybody know that people are in the BCC. You know, dear Jeff, congratulations, our team in the BCC. And so all those congratulations go to you and me, but they don't go to everybody in the office.
Right.
A second way I'd like to illustrate is networking. We have a whole chapter on microskills for networking, which I think a lot of people sometimes don't realize the importance of that microskill for navigating the workplace. And say you heard about this very famous emergency medicine physician, award-winning mentor, Dr. Adara Landry, and you and I are friends, and you, Risa, I really have been wanting to get a meeting with Dr. Adara Landry. Do you think you could introduce me? And I say, yes, sure, Jeff, like I'd love to. So I send an email introducing the two of you. And in reply, you drop me down to the BCC and you say, dear Dr. Landry, you know, I really would like to set up a meeting. Thanks, Risa, parentheses in BCC. So number one, I see it. Number two, I'm now taken out of the conversation because I don't need to continue on that conversation string. And Adara knows that you are acknowledging and thanking me, but isn't seeing me. So, you know, compassionate, really respectful, kind way to utilize the BCC.
I love it. When it comes to new opportunities, we can be quick to say yes. What, in your estimation, can we learn from taking a pause when it comes to being given potential new opportunities?
When I was early in my career, I was told, say yes to everything. I don't know if you heard that ever before, Jeff, but was like very commonly spread around. Any sort of career development, mentoring, meeting I went to as a college student, as a medical student, it was like, just say yes to everything. You never know what you're going to miss out on. And you know, looking back now, it's quite toxic advice, because what happens is you say yes to things that you're not interested in, familiar with, or you have an understanding of. And a lot of it is driven out of fear, the fear of missing out, FOMO, because you're just like, oh, I was told to say yes. What if this is the big thing for me?
Right.
And so I actually tell my students, don't say yes to everything. Say, tell me more, because I think there is a lot of room to being neutral in your questioning, your research, your data collection about this opportunity. And you're asking things like, is this opportunity funded? Will I have administrative support? Have you done this before? Who is on my team? What is the timeline? How many hours do you expect this to be? And these are questions that you will find out eventually, even if you don't ask. But boy, isn't it better to know that up front and go talk to your personal board of directors, which we write about a lot. You know, it's a known concept in the business world, right? Like this team of people who you go to and tell them, like, this is the opportunity that was pitched to me. I asked these follow-up questions and these were their responses. Mm-hmm. What else should I consider? What am I missing? What do you think of this? And that's more information, more insight. And then you go back and say, you know, after further consideration, this seems like a great opportunity for me. I'm wondering if I can make these few alterations. You know, I can't do it now. So my answer isn't no. It's, can we push this a few months? Whatever your answer might be, it's going to be a lot more informed than that impulsive yes, or even the impulsive no that might make it seem like you're just not interested at all.
The power of the pause we bring up, and that's threaded throughout, not just when you have an opportunity presented, but even in situations of workplace conflict, in situations where, in our chapter on being a team player, you witness some sort of aggressive comment, some sort of bullying situation, you know, think and then act, you know, collect yourself. We, in the emergency department, are faced with lots of sick patients that have mental illness, can be violent, all sorts of things. And, you know, this concept of pausing, then acting, pausing, then speaking, pausing, take a deep breath, even going back to the self-care of, you know, having some sort of yoga meditation, you know, practice, all these things are threaded of just pause and then go. But there's almost always time to pause.
Another area of struggle for a lot of leaders is, and really it's on both sides, is this area of feedback and knowing how to give good feedback and feedback that others can actually use and benefit from. And what do your experiences tell you about how to do that and how to do it effectively? And again, in a way that people can actually use the feedback.
We are in an environment of feedback, just like many, many industries. Mm. And actually, commonly trainees say at the end of a shift, medical students, can you give me feedback? And it's so difficult, usually actually after a shift, and that kind of just question, which they've been told they have to ask, and we know that we are supposed to respond. And to be clear, there are books, many books written about feedback, and I'm a big reader. Leaders read, readers lead. I don't know who said that, but you know, there's a book about which I'm fond called Thanks for the Feedback, Sheila Heen et al. I've spoken with her, and I've actually tried to incorporate different forms of feedback. And there's the asking for feedback, and then there's the giving feedback. And in the book, we try to talk about both. So I think I can advise a few things. Number one, pick a technique that works. And one that I like is the start, stop, continue. And I would use that a lot because I would find if I was in a supervisor role, people that are more junior to me or on my team often felt very uncomfortable, I think really feeling like they could give me feedback. And so the start, stop, continue kind of neutralized it. And they actually, I think, felt really good telling me something. Again, the start, the continue, and then the stop part then felt easier. I think a technique I've also found successful is just one thing. And this comes from Sheila, that after a talk, people are like, that was a great talk. And people are like, oh, thank you. And you're always like, do they really mean it? Do they say that to everybody? So I follow up, and Adara has witnessed me do this follow up. Oh, you know, thank you so much. What was one thing that you thought was effective, or what one thing moved you, or what one thing do you think I should do in my next talk? And actually, then that's like truth serum, because people are either caught off guard, they have nothing to say, in which case it was just sort of the I'm like, oh, they say that to everybody. Or they're like, actually, the story that you shared was really personal and really illustrated the point you were making, something like that.
I can endorse that. Risa definitely does this often. And I have started to do it too, because you get really helpful feedback. And I want to add that, you know, we talked a little bit about giving feedback, but I think the best feedback you're going to receive is really coming from a place where you're asking a very specific question up front. And I had a resident, and I've never seen this before, a junior trainee who would come to work with a flashcard, and he would have specific things that he wanted to work on that shift. And so at the top of the shift, he would say, you know, Dr. Landry, can you watch me teach the medical student how to do an exam? I really want to make sure I'm doing that correctly. Or can you read my notes and then tell me if you feel like they're clear or not clear? They were so specific that it was really easy and inviting for me to track and to monitor versus, like Risa said, at the end of the shift, we get a lot of people coming to us saying, how did I do? It's like, well, what do you want me to comment on? Right. What are you in the mindset of learning about? Right. Because otherwise I'm just guessing. And so by inviting people to a particular problem or issue or skill that you want evaluated, it does make the other side much more easier to do.
I love that. I want to move now to the bane of my existence. and that's networking events or networking more broadly. You know, I'm somebody who I consider myself to be an ambivert. I lean more introverted, but you know, I can be extroverted when I need to be. But I've always had a major dislike for networking, and specifically network events and those types of things. And I know that's something a lot of people struggle with. Like, what do I do? What do I say? How do I present myself? What advice would you have for overcoming a discomfort with networking?
I'll start and say that I realized the importance of networking over time by watching colleagues, and also another book I read that was called How Women Rise. And they say that what gets you to early and mid-career promotions may not get you to the next level, the C-suite, the ultimate leadership position. And one of the actionable items in that book they talk about is networking. Now, networking sounds kind of, it could be creepy. It could sound a little superficial and contrived. So sometimes I like using the word connecting because that sounds a little bit more heartfelt and human. The bottom line is we deem it so important that we actually wrote a chapter about it. And we talk to the reader about creating relationships that stick. And we actually do one specific micro skill on networking for introverts. So I strongly identify as an introvert. Now, I'm socially adept. I can speak in front of hundreds of people. I don't feel uncomfortable at a cocktail party of strangers. And also where I regroup, where I get my energy, where I recharge, my preferential interactions are one-on-one. They're basically solo and or small group. So unsurprisingly, almost every workplace networking events are built for extroverts, even though Myers-Briggs says that about 57% of us identify as introverts. So I had found that over time, when I would go to large medical conferences, I had created these adaptive behaviors because I just felt so drained. Rather than staying at the main conference hotel, I'd stay at an adjacent hotel where I could slip away. Rather than the large department dinners, I would plan make a booking at a restaurant for four people. So the conversations were more intentional and went deeper. And that's just what worked for me. I love walking meetings. In fact, my team would often make fun of me because people would be like, did Reese ask you to do a walking meeting? And the thing is, everybody actually loves them. And also you read about them. I definitely did not come up with them, but a lot of people don't actually do them. I love doing them. They're fun. So we basically emphasize to the reader that networking is something to be valued and it's something that's learnable. And we break it down into some critical action steps of the how-to.
The other thing about networking is finding the right medium. So you might have discomfort with networking at conferences, but you might actually love networking via social media. That's what I love. So I love actually using social media like Twitter/X and LinkedIn, and even now Instagram. I'm more on Instagram to direct message people, to connect with people. I'm not actually a big poster. You would see very few posts from me on like throughout the week, but I'm sending a ton of direct messages to people who are posting content that is aligned with mine, who I think I can maybe collaborate with. We've gotten a ton of opportunities via just randomly cold messaging people on social media and forming relationships that way. So it doesn't have to be in person at conferences. You know, for folks at home with kids, like travel is limited for me. And so I have found the social media realm to be quite satisfying and making up the deficit that I have by not traveling.
You know, I always thought it was a bit of an oddball. I would just like you in that sense, Adara, in that the in-person networking, I never really took to, but social media, I just found that to come so naturally. And I thought, does that make me weird?
Well, you know what? It's like there's a stigmatized phrase that I learned when I joined with the kids on social media called like being in someone's DMs. Yeah. And I said, oh, is that like a bad thing? And I'm like, yeah, that's a bad thing. But you know, I don't even see it that way. I'm just like messaging someone like, hey, I saw your post. Totally agree. I do similar work. Let me know if you ever want to connect. And you're just like laying out the groundwork, and they might not respond, but they might. And that's the best part.
I know our time is limited. Let me ask you a question related to this topic of brainstorming that you talk about in the book, and this idea of creating a list of ideas without any fear of judgment or need to commit to that idea. Talk about or unpack that, if you would, this idea of putting down thoughts, ideas, brainstorms without judgment or need to commit.
You know, I am someone who always has ideas. It's like a personality trait for me. When my husband and I watch this show called Shark Tank, the moment the show is over, he looks at me and he's like, what are your five ideas? I know you have five ideas. And it's so true because I always do. You know, I think of the brainstorming process as it truly is like a mental exercise to see what you are interested in, what you are capable of doing. It's also really fun just to think about how to scale down and up some of your ideas. Every once in a while, I'll have a project. And I'm like, okay, let's say with Risa, we're going to write articles together. That was the initial landscape of who we were, which is writing articles. But then I thought, why don't we write a book? Like, that's a next step. That's another thing. And we started brainstorming book topics and book titles. Mm-hmm. And it really needed to be this safe space where we're thinking about what we want to talk about. And I remember having multiple conversations in the way beginning about just even book topics that we wanted to talk about. You know, I think at one point we did think about maybe writing a book for physicians or early career medical students, for instance. It was on the list, but it's a great moment to see how big, how small you want to go. It's also really fun because you haven't yet committed and you can take this list and show it to other people. The problem with committing too early is that now you feel emotionally tied to an idea before you have been able to see all of the reasons and ways and holes and gaps that your idea is not going to turn out to be anything. And so, you know, when you have this list of ideas and you start pitching it to people, they can say, this is why it's not going to work because someone's already doing it. It's already been overdone. It's never going to catch on. And you're like, okay, great. I'm not committed to it yet. I'm not emotionally tied to this. So the brainstorm is this free for all, free spirit way of just seeing what's possible without feeling like you're locked in.
This comes from our chapter in developing subject matter expertise. At the beginning of the book, we share three truths. One is time is only spent. Number two is the world is not equal. We all start from different places, be it because of financial resources, be it because of our networks, be it because of, you know, our pedigree. And then the third truth related to this is that learning is limitless if only accessible. The brainstorming exercise opens up that accessibility to learning. And if you partner that with, for example, someone on your personal board of directors, then you can really expand and no judgment, you know, no self-consciousness, just write it all down, get it all down. And what you shared, who knows where it will go or it won't go, and it doesn't matter.
Well, what have I not asked you maybe that you want to make sure people know about? Anything from you, Adara, that you want to make sure you add to the conversation before we wrap up?
When we were writing this book, we actually wanted to make it feel as accessible as possible. That's why that tagline on the top of the book, you know, buy this book on a Friday, better at your job on Monday, really speaks to this idea that we didn't want the advice that we give to feel like it would take you years to implement it into your life.
Right.
So we don't recommend go out and get a PhD or go out and get an MBA or move to a different country. Mm. Like, we're not suggesting that. We tried to find topics that could be easily implementable once you just say, I feel committed to making this change. And we recognize that change is hard, which is why we structured the book to start with a vignette that really shows each micro skill that we're teaching. It's because it's a lesson that Risa and I have learned through a success, a failure, or even an observation of someone else. And then we go into why you need to create the change. And I think what's probably most important for each of these micro skills is why it's hard to create the change, and really just normalizing that, yes, we're giving a lot of strategic advice, but we also recognize that you are human and that you have limited money or time or networks or experience. And so even though we are suggesting a micro skill for you, we know that it might not be accomplished at the snap of your fingers. And then we get into the critical actions. But our overall goal when we were coming up with these micro skills and the critical actions within them was always to, let's make it easy for the reader. Let's make it something that can be achieved and sort of keeping in mind accessibility throughout.
When we were doing this survey of the business self-help literature and looking at comp titles, what we saw and how we know this book is different is we tell the reader how. A lot of times books tell you what to do. They're very prescriptive, but they don't break it down into the how. So, you know, you've had, for example, Stephen Covey's family member or James Clear. Those were some of our comp titles. And how we think we're different and complementary in this space is breaking it down for the people that don't understand the actual logistics, the 1, 2, 3. And these micro skills, these small fundamental building blocks, they build upon each other, they translate, they transfer. And we know that when people start ingesting them, digesting them, that they'll start utilizing them and applying that thought process to almost every large task, large project, habit, fill in the blank. And so, yeah, we really appreciate the opportunity to share this with you and that the content resonated with you.
Well, the book, again, is called Micro Skills, Small Actions, Big Impact. I suggest you buy it. It is available the same day this episode is being released. You can get it right now on Amazon or wherever you buy books. Doctors Adara Landry and Risa Lewis, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedules to appear here on the Read to Lead podcast. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us. I've enjoyed this conversation.
Amazing, amazing. Thank you again.
Once again, this book releases today. You can get it right now wherever you buy books. I'll link to it in the show notes page for this episode, along with the books that were mentioned during the course of our conversation. Books like Write Useful Books and How Women Rise, among others. All that and more can be found at this address, readtoleadpodcast.com/523 for episode 523. There you'll also find a link for more on joining the Read to Lead community with a Read to Lead Plus membership. Find out how you can start a free 2-week trial right now. You can also go directly to jeffbrown.me. Our plan next week is to welcome author Jorge Arango, who's written a book near and dear to my heart called Duly Noted, Extend Your Mind Through Connected Notes. That is next time on the Read to Lead podcast.
That does it for this week. I hope to see you next time. Until then, remember, leaders read and readers lead.